Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have a Team Ignite portfolio company founder and CEO, Ladaram Vishnoi. Ladaram, would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Thank you, Brian, for having me in the podcast. I'm really excited to have, really excited to be here. My name is Ladaram, founder and CEO of a company called Middleware. Quick intro about me. I moved here in 2016, moved from London. I started a company called Acquire, and we were getting quite a bit customer from San Francisco. So I just came here first time to meet some of the customers, some of those advisors. And I really love the ecosystem here. So I permanently moved here in 2016.
Once you visit San Francisco, you sort of fall in love with it, right? Yeah. You're kind of like, this is a really nice town. I'm going to come back.
Yeah. So then I moved here permanently, and I run that company almost like 6.5 years, 7 years, roughly. I raised like $57 million in venture for that company. Took that company just by myself to like roughly 200 people. And then after that, I was like thinking, I want to like take some break and I want to be VC. I was that. I did not like that part a little bit.
I'd love to dig into that, right? Because being a VC is looked at as taking a break as a founder. What did you not like about being a VC? I'd love to hear this.
It was like you being an operator and then now you being advisors in these two different games. You're looking for like 1, 2, 3, maybe 4, 5 deal like years, and like you talk to thousands of people, and now like, man, this is not for me. I'm like kind of
Is brutal. That kind of funnel where you're talking to, yeah, like 1,000 people a year, and you're only able to invest in one or two every quarter.
Yeah,
that's such a brutal funnel. I can't imagine being that kind of concentrated of a VC. That would be terrible.
Yeah, then so I give up really fast there, and then so I would like think about like what should we do. The next one, should I go back to Acquire and run that, or should I like start something else? So I finally decide to start something else, and that was Middleware. I started Middleware in 2022, like mid of 2022. Yeah, so that was like quick intro.
So what is Middleware, and kind of how did you get that idea?
So what actually happened, Middleware, what we do, we are like observability platforms. So we monitor cloud and applications and how applications running inside the cloud. At 2017, 2018, what actually happened is like, so we were building our V2 version of software in my previous company called Acquire. And we were looking for observability because we were building software using Kubernetes, microservices, cloud natives, all the latest tech. Mm. And we were looking for observability, and there wasn't that many tools in the market. There was only like one company was doing it. We asked the quotation to them, and there was like 3x of our cloud bill. So like, screw this, dude. Like, we can't afford this. So what we did is like, I put like few engineers together, just me and few more engineers, and on weekends and night. So we built like a small version of observability in 2017, 2018.
At your previous startup.
That's correct, yeah. So when I was thinking about the idea, I was like, oh, actually I know exactly like what we're going to do. And from day one, I put my own like $500,000 to the company and hired 15 engineers, and we just start building it. Silently, we were building for almost in a year the product. Mm.
Wow. How did your previous investors feel about that? Because now you're using company resources to spin up a new company. And did they get equity in this company? This is the classic story, right? In Silicon Valley, you know, I think of Flickr is the most famous example with Slack, as they... he was on his like second gaming startup. The founder, I forget his name, Stuart Butterfield.
Stuart Butterfield, yeah.
And so he's on his second. He's always wanted to build a hit video game, which I have a soft spot in my heart for because I'm a gamer. And so he's on the second gaming startup that he got funded because he founded Flickr, and they're at the end of it, and there's no traction. So the VCs are like, "What else you got?" Like, well, we got this like messaging app.
Yeah.
That turned out to be a $30 billion company. So
that's correct. So we didn't use the code that what we built at, like in my previous company.
Yeah.
We just start from scratch. And then things was like, why we start from scratch is like that thing, we just patch it and we put it together something.
Yeah.
It's not as scalable like what we doing now. Like we handle like almost over 3-4 petabyte of data a month. That's like a crazy.
Yeah. What was the moment where you realized you had something? Like, okay, observability is this thing. We needed to build something. We hacked something together to solve that problem. There's probably lots of other companies that have that problem.
So the biggest thing is how we realize is like the problem already in the market, and there is like a lot of legacy providers like doing the monitoring for even like cloud natives, Kubernetes, and I'm like legacy like old like almost decade old companies just came in the market, and they become so expensive, and their tool is like kind of okay. It's not like give you so much detail, and they like trying to do everything, and when you trying to do everything, it's like everything get lost, like into funnel or into like large data warehouse. Then when you like trying to do cost optimizings or even trying to optimizing for your resources or all those things, it's just like incredible hard. That was like how we can simplify the solutions specifically for all latest tech, and that's like cloud native, Kubernetes, microservices, all of that part. Yeah. And then like there was a spark, and I talked to like a bunch of my friend, they are engineers, and they're working for like larger company, and they were like every single one was facing their problems.
Yeah, I love the story. It's something we look at as an investor, is we find teams that have built something internally, say at a big tech company or a startup, and they realize like, hey, we built this thing and it's not differentiating internally for us to have this homegrown thing that everybody's going to need anyway. So why don't we just go build a SaaS, enterprise SaaS company around this new technology that we develop and sell this to everybody? And it's probably not a customer facing, SaaS product. It's just the middleware of a SaaS company. It's this stuff that sits lower in the stack that everybody needs.
Yeah.
And then did you guys went straight enterprise, not open source, right?
So no, we are not planning to go open source. We have some part of the product is open source, that our agent that people just install inside their cloud and inside their machine, that part is just open source, but rest is a closed source. And also we are not planning to go open source, to be really honest. Yeah.
And what was that decision like? Because a lot of these, a lot of these enterprise kind of developer focused platforms do go open source. What was that decision like for you guys?
So we were thinking like we probably need to choose our strategy, like how we're going to do it and what our strategy is going to be for open source or closed source. We early on, we decided like we probably going to be closed source, and there's no specific reason, but we feel like open source is like easier to get early tractions, but later tractions is really hard. And then when it got really famous, like all the cloud companies just going to come and just copy your product, put in their
change the code just enough to avoid litigation and
or even
blatantly fork it and offer it as a first party service like AWS has done many, many times in the past.
Yeah, there's many like now, like yep. Kafka, like let's say the company built the Kafka, and then now AWS deployed it, Azure deployed it, and GCP deployed it, and now why you need to go to their, what a company called Confluent, why you need to go
Confluent,
to Confluent?
Yeah.
Why you need to go to Confluent to do that? Like, so Confluent is like, I'm like, it's a great company, but like at some point it's just like hitting a ceiling. So I don't want to hit that ceiling.
Yeah. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then what was the decision making process to go to YC, right? Cause you're already a successful founder. You've raised money. You've scaled a team. What was that conversation like?
So a bunch of my friend actually went through YC, and I was thinking, I never been to the YC for my previous startups, and I was thinking, should I go, should I not go, should I go, should I not go? Then actually, one of the partner of the YC also know me, and he was like, you should try it. You're a solo founder, it's totally worth it. And then I got more convinced from the network of the YC. There is no observability company been through YC before. So I was like, okay, there's huge networks I can probably leverage to sell my product there. Then I was like the YC have a like amazing reputations too, and I'm like solo founder, so I can probably afford it too. So I was like, okay, let's try it. And
yeah, I mean, if you're a solo founder, that's a really good equation, right? Is like, yeah. Take 7%, you know, that's not a big deal. Because if you have a co-founder or a couple, you're already diluted a ton.
That's correct.
Yeah. And yeah, for the audience that doesn't know, you know, YC does something like 7% for 125K, and then it's another 375 MFN, which means it converts at whatever the best terms are when you do another priced round.
Yeah, it's not a priced round. Even you do note round, that will convert at that cap once your batches start. So once your batches start, after the batches start, whatever the round you raise and whatever the cap, the 375 convert and that
would the best cap basically.
Best cap.
Yeah.
Best.
So somebody comes in and writes you a huge $3 million check at a $9 million valuation. That's what YC is going to get as well.
That's correct. Yeah.
And so tell us about the decision to go solo, right? Because you obviously have tons of people, you know. You had this previous successful startup. Was it just like, hey, I've done this, I've been there before, and I don't need any help, and I could just hire the help. Like, what was that? Yeah,
it's a both, to be really honest, right? So first, I was like talking to a bunch of people, and I was like, okay, I can probably get a co-founder.
Yeah,
but then I start working on it. I build the team, and once I build the team, and we start building the product, and we're like, do I really need it? I can hire the person actually.
Yeah.
I can give like a decent equity early on.
Yeah,
give a like. Founding engineer role and give equity, and then I was like, okay. I build the company until Series B, took the company to 200 people, so I'm like kind of know until what happened at Series B.
You know how to do it, yeah.
So yeah,
first-time founders, I really like to see co-founders, but like if you're a second or third-time founder and you're a solo founder, I'm not as concerned. I'm really concerned if you're a first-time founder, solo founder, as an investor. But you know that, and that's why we invested in you. It's like, okay, he's on his second or third thing here, and he's going to probably be successful. He's been successful in the past, but kind of talk through, like, for entrepreneurs, there's lots of, you know, founders out there listening to this that are incubating their idea. How should they think through whether or not to have a co-founder?
I personally believe like you need to have co-founder early on. If you are the first time, please do have a co-founder. Like it's going to be incredibly hard. because it's depressing. So at the same day, you're gonna be like happy and cheering, and same day you're gonna be crying.
You just need somebody. You need somebody to just to commiserate with.
It's because the biggest is emotional support. Sometimes you give up and you're like, man, I can't do it. And then once you give up, but once you're a co-founder, he's like, okay, like no, we're gonna do it. Then the other person is down. The other person is taking up. So I'm like, make sure you have different skill of the co-founders, like one engineer, one business, that could be like ideal. Even both engineer could be ideal too, but like both go to our business people, then it's going to be really hard early on. Yeah.
How do you, like, if you're building that's great advice, by the way. If you're building something that is customer facing, not so much like the middleware, but like more of a traditional app application layer, SaaS app, how important do you think it is to have a design co-founder?
So design co-founder is getting quite a bit important now.
Yeah.
If it's B2C product, then it's getting quite a bit important, because getting a really good designers or UX and UI person is really important for B2C founders. B2B as well is getting importance, but like I personally feel like engineers is the most important part.
Being able to build, yeah.
Yeah, they know, like, I'm like, you probably get a designer from somewhere, but then I'm like, yeah, you need an engineer to build the product and to take complete ownership.
And there's lots of great examples where the design isn't great, but the company has just executed.
Yep.
And really great enterprise software, I think, has to do whatever the customer needs. And it doesn't always have to look the best. I mean, look at Microsoft's really improved over the years, but I'm thinking of like Salesforce. You know, that's the classic.
Reddit. Yeah. You can look at Reddit. Probably, like, I don't know if they have designer or not. Like Craigslist.
They execute. They just execute the features.
That's it. Yeah. And they're doing pretty good too, right?
So for potential customers listening out there that are interested in this observability stack, you know, what should they know about middleware? What kind of problems are they facing? How do they know that they're a good fit for what you guys do?
So So what we're trying to fix the problem there is like observability is becoming expensive and expensive. We like straight away cut the cost for 3-4x easily. And so I give you an example. We have one large ride-hailing company from Asia. They using one of our competitors, sending like 1 petabyte of data outside their infra to to one of our competitors for the observability. They're paying over like $2 million just ingestions. Just like means sending data outside a cloud bill.
So their egress is $2 million a year?
Yes. So
wow.
What we did, we did on-prem deploy inside own cloud in the same data centers in where they're using AWS.
And
they're
closer to where the observability needs to happen, so you don't have to transfer petabytes of data to where it's going to be observed.
That's correct, yeah. So you don't need to send it via public networks, and you just keep all the data like within the same data center, so you don't pay any egress cost.
Mm.
And I think most of the company do... struggling with this issue, they don't realize. They do realize at some point, but then like we just are wearing a lot of people. We just hey, like you're just paying a huge amount of the cost for egress. You can cut down complete egress cost. We do on prem, and you're running our cloud is going to be like really smaller cost, and then you can save 3-4x your observability bill. So that means like you save like almost 5-6x like easily into your observability cost. So that's how we're trying to go into enterprise and then saving like a large amount of the, large amount of the money there. Yeah,
that's a ton. So why couldn't existing observability platforms just deploy on the customer tenant?
So then they need to completely build the whole the on-prem solutions. It's like they build for cloud and they're running for cloud for decades. And now if they really go, then there's completely new solutions they need to build. That. So it's not that easy to build.
They were kind of architected with all the S3, EC2 kind of infrastructure stuff from a decade ago. And now to kind of go back and go, oh, and now I need to like kind of fit this app that I've built up across these dozens and dozens of services on AWS and Azure. And try to retrofit it into a customer's on-prem either data center or on-prem implementation of Azure or AWS. And it's just too much work.
Yep.
It ends up being like cost prohibitive.
Completely agree with you. Yep.
That's amazing. So what's in store for the future for middleware? Where do you kind of see this in a decade or so?
So right now we're focusing a lot of automations. We putting a lot of AI into the observability. How like the biggest problem right now is like observability have a vast amount of data, and then now if engineer go dev and ops team like any person go to the observability stack and they look at them trying to debug the issues, they have like millions of logs, they have like a lot of metrics and traces, and they get, like all the data is produced there. Now when you're trying to debug, it's so hard. What we're trying to do, we're just trying to train a lot of data to the AI, and then we give you 5 to 10 action items that you really need to take care of it. Rather than like you look at all the dashboards, like there are going to be thousands of dashboards to look at it. So that's going to be the future. I think that's what we're building right now. So like the action item, that's what you need to look at it. Rest is just like, and the action item is just drive through all the data that we collect. And then we train to the AI, and then AI give like recommendations that, okay, that's what you need to look at right now to improve your systems, or that latency is later there, or there is a like error produced there. So you just go and look at it, make sure there's no false error, make sure all the data, all the errors or all the alert is actual alert rather than false positives.
Yeah. Well, and I think that leads into another great follow-up question, and I'd be remiss with all the AI hype if I didn't ask it, which is, you know, how does AI affect what you're doing? Given large language models can now read the logs and things like that, like how do you see it impacting in the coming years?
It did not affect that much into the observability market, to be really honest. And then the companies start doing, some of the companies start putting some of the observability. They start putting like chatbot style, like you can ask the questions, but then you can't automate everything in observability from the AI because it cannot solve the problem. You can't, AI can't fix the problem for you. It can tell you the problem, but it can't fix the problem. And because even let's say it can fix the problem and then it's automate and fix something and then it's break somewhere else, then it will like mess up whole the system because it's pretty early for the observability stack. give a power for engineer to debug the issues, and it will easier to find the issues than actually fix everything. That what AI is doing in our market, and I think that will grow in next like 2, 3, 4 years, and it might change something there.
Yeah. Well, let's switch to a rapid fire, if you don't mind.
Let's do it.
What's your biggest lesson you learned from your time at YC, Y Combinator?
Move fast. Grow fast, move fast, 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 fast.
Tell us, like, do you have any stories about kind of that 3-month sprint to demo day?
So they have this group session every 2 weeks. And those are so intense group sessions for like 10 companies. They put it together, group sessions. They ask the update, like what you achieved in last like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Those are brutal. Like,
yeah.
Like some company doing it, some company not doing it. And then when you see like some company are doing it and they're crushing it, then you feel so so sorry for you. Like you're like, what going on? Like I need to push it really hard on this one.
Yeah.
Those are the best.
A little peer pressure, a little bit.
It's not.
Like, we just grew 100%. We grew 100% in the last 2 weeks. And you're like, crap, I only grew like 5% or 10%.
Yeah. It's not a peer pressure. It's a crazy pressure. And that pressure was great, actually. I love that pressure. And then we internally start doing the pressure. Right now, we also doing the pressure. It's like, hey, after the YC, we kind of stopped doing for like 3 months. And now like, oh, no shit. Like, actually, we need to do that. I think that was the amazing pressure that we had. Then we start doing it. And actually, like, we see the result like immediately. Yeah.
It reminds me of a story from my favorite book, which I'll ask you your favorite book on business. Or one of my favorite books was Hard Thing About Hard Things, where he kind of tells a story. You know, I think the company was LoudCloud and Horowitz, and it's failing, right? And you know, like they have to go re-architect everything and redo everything to succeed and survive. Mm-hmm. And he basically tells everybody, a 1,000-person company, something like that, if you're not willing to work 80 to 100-hour weeks for the next 6 months, you should leave the company because this is what it's going to take to survive.
That's good.
We're all hands on deck. This is survival. If we come out the other side, it's going to be great for us, but we may not. So it's risky. And I think I don't remember what percentage left, but a good percentage of people left the company, 20%, maybe 20-30%. They're like, I'm not willing to sacrifice.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, startup is not for 40 hour a week that you're just chilling and you're doing that. Startup is just you signing up for 80 to 100 hour a week. And if you can't, then please do not sign up. I personally recommend, please do not sign up. This is really hard.
Especially at the earliest stages, like pre-Series A, I should say. Like once you get to like Series A or B, you can start hiring those kind of 40, 50 hour a week kind of people, I think. But would you agree or?
Yeah, I completely agree. Like
until
A, like you need to crush it for next like 2-3 years. Those 2-3 years, it just make or break a business. And then if you start chilling for those 2-3 years, then I'm like, it's going to be really hard to grow the startup to take to the A or B or C, like something like that. So
yeah. And we as investors can tell, right? Like, we tried to tell ahead of time before we wired the money, but we can definitely tell after we wire the money and we start seeing your updates. We can tell if you're hustling or not, you know? I love it. How do you select for people that are going to grind it out with you, especially before like pre-Series A, call it?
So you can see the hustle in the person. So when you meet the person, it's just like, for us, like the skill is less important than the culture fit and hustle. Like if you really hustle, you can probably learn the skill and you can get it done. If you don't have that, we probably like kind of try to avoid it. Like that's the easiest thing to look at it early on.
Yeah.
And we look at like that one is just a main thing into the people.
But how do you select for that? So like you're interviewing 3 candidates, they're all on paper pretty equal, you know, they seem to have similar skills. Like what is it about the hustle? Oh, like this guy grew up poor, worked, you know, like really hard, went to like okay school, but then he's been you know, I can tell he's hustling because he has like a bunch of GitHub stars or something, or a bunch of pull requests. Like, how do you select for hustle?
So I have like my method, and my method is like, we have a team in India, and we have like 30 people in India, like in mostly engineer there. And then we hire the people here. And then my question is like, hey, we do our stand-up 8:30 p.m. Pacific. Can you join?
Just like 9 in the morning there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like 10 in morning now. But
yeah,
it will change like after that. So then they were like, hey, can you join those one? And then the person say like, oh man, I have this and I have that. And I was like, okay, I'm done. Like person say like, yeah, of course. Like, oh, I'm going to join it.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah. Whatever it takes. And the person, like how the person actually give the answer of the questions is all the matter. And then questions like, yeah, person say like, yeah, of course I will join it. Then I was like, can you work like 1 or 2 hours in a night? Don't come in early morning at 9 o'clock in the office. Like, we totally fine. You can come 10, 11. Like, you can come at 10, 10:30. Totally fine. Can you do those 2 hours? Then they were like, oh, yeah, actually, I love working in a night.
8:30 to 10:30. Yeah.
Yeah. They say, like, I love working in a night and I can do that. That will define is like, yeah, you actually are 9-to-5 person, or you are like, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's just like whenever business need me. And it worked pretty good. Actually, I had a few people and I let them go because of they were like, oh, I can't attend this stand up. Like, yeah. So like few of them is totally fine. Like,
yeah, you got something going on, or
yeah, something going on, totally fine. Like, you miss like maybe 1 or 2 a week, totally fine. But you like every single one you can't attend it. I'm like, okay, I'm done.
yeah. Obviously, this isn't important to you. You're not aligned to the mission and the culture and the values of the company and. Yeah. So how do you unwind? You know, you're working super tough, super hard at the startup, you know, 80 hours a week or whatever.
So I normally can't sleep that much on weekdays. I sleep on the weekend. That's the one thing. And on Saturday, I normally go on a hike and just go by myself sometime, unwind and just do that. I do a lot of meditations on Sunday. A lot of means like sometimes like 3, 4, 5 hours, sometimes maybe an hour. Yeah. So I do that. And it's unwinding is a mental blockage. Like, you can train your brain in such a way that you are unwinding or you're not unwinding. It's just all about like how you train your brain. And, you know, like, so it doesn't bother me too much.
Yeah.
If I'm unwinding or not unwinding.
Yeah. I do TM, which is from the Vedic tradition. So I do that twice a day, and that helps me like just kind of, you know, peel off all the stress.
That's correct.
Yeah. If you could co-found a startup with any tech mogul, who would it be and why?
Oh, that amazing. Maybe Sam Altman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No doubt, right?
Or yeah, Elon. He's amazing.
Elon Musk.
Elon. Yeah, probably Elon.
Yeah.
Besides hustle, because we talked about that, what's the most underrated skill in tech entrepreneurs today?
Communications. That's like... most underrating skill is, I personally feel, is communications, no doubt. Whatever the talented person you are, if you cannot communicate, is so difficult. I learned that like really, really late stage, but like you need to communicate. Communicate is the key thing for the startups to grow. Like, you probably can like take the startup to like, I'm like pick up like early on. But then to take to next level, like, you need to communicate, you need to sell. You need to sell to the people you are hiring, to the VCs, to the customers, to the podcast, like any of those things. Communications is the key skill, I personally feel.
I love that. What's your go-to productivity hack?
Coffee.
It's funny you mentioned that, because today I was supposed to get my blood drawn for, you know, just a routine medical thing. And the phlebotomist did not show up. And so I'm sitting here fasted without coffee all morning. It was just terrible. Just cranky and tired and like, just, you know, I need that cup of coffee in the morning to just get going.
Yeah.
But I'm from Seattle, so we all drink like a pot of coffee up there.
Yeah, Portland is all about coffee, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you had like a time machine or like a time machine email apparatus, machine. What's one piece of advice you'd send back to your younger self?
That's a great question, to be honest. I could have learned some skill that I did not learn early on, because I probably didn't know. Learning a skill on summer, I think, is the best things I could have done. But then we were just kind of like playing and doing something and never learned the skills. So could have learned some kind of skill. So yeah, learning something, like, do not stop learning.
Yeah, spend the summers like having hobbies and learning and creating and
yeah,
not just playing video games all summer and playing outside all summer or whatever.
That's really, really important. Yeah, playing video games, like,
yeah,
kind of like, it's okay sometimes you should do it, but I'm like, learning a skill that will serve you for the rest of the life, then the video game not gonna serve you the rest of your life.
Yeah, until the next one comes out, you know.
Yeah,
I'm joking. Last question. What's a book that's significantly influenced your thought process and how you go about your career?
What was your question? Sorry.
What's your favorite book that influenced your thought process?
There was a book, it's called Courage to be Disliked. Is actually opened my brain. That was one book, like, I was pretty in the mire. Like, I learned a lot of things from that. And second is, like, the book I'm reading is, like, I'm halfway, Power of Subconscious Mind. It's just like how you train your brain, like, to be a subconscious, like, we have two memories, subconscious and conscious. Like, whatever we see and we do in the conscious mind is always train our subconscious mind, and subconscious mind is power our conscious minds. I personally feel it's an amazing book. The people should read it.
Power of Subconscious Mind. I'll check that out. Power of
Subconscious Mind. Yeah, it's amazing. I haven't finished it yet. I'm just in the halfway yet. But
reminds me of, like, Thinking Fast and Slow, the Daniel Kahneman.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's this subsystem, system one, system two.
Yeah.
And
other way around is like, hey, if I really want to attract something, I need to train my subconscious mind for that. Then it does happen, because your conscious mind will do the act is come from the subconscious minds. So it was pretty deep. Like, I read four chapters, and both four chapters I read it twice to understand completely. it was an amazing book.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. How can prospective employees and customers get in touch with you?
They can reach me out on LinkedIn. I'm always accept everyone LinkedIn request, and I always reply on the inbox. If they are not selling, then yeah, then I'll reply. So LinkedIn is easier. Email is easier, like laduram@middleware.io. Simply to reach me out or email.
Right. Thank you so much, Laduram, for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure the audience will find a lot of value from your tidbits of wisdom.
Thank you, Brian. Really appreciate for the time.
Thanks. Bye.